So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
Something very arrogant and obnoxious about him. And he's a guy with a big mouth. I guess what it is a certain lack of masculinity that he never possessed. And, I finally just got where I couldn't take it anymore. The dancing and the twirling around the ring, that Mexican-style wrestling is enough to make you sick.
Because the last time I took him up on the challenge was WrestleMania, and I beat his ass for that stupid piece of tin he's got on his shoulder.
People like me and myself that are tough, the truckers and the lumberjacks and the coal miners that come home from a long day and sit home in front of that Saturday and turn on the WWF and they want to see a real man on TV instead of a guy dressed up in little mirrors and glittering chains and earrings and got a little tattoo, a little heart on his arm and stuff. I think that stuff is hard to wash after a while.
Well, folks, this match was a year and a half in the making and probably will never, ever happen again. I certainly encourage you to join us for this history-making event this Sunday, exclusively on pay-per-view at the Survivor Series.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting with you. It is Monday, November the 3rd, 1997, on today's show.
Oh, yes. Oh, okay.
Yes. God. How are you, Wei?
I'm all right. Not bad. Yourself?
I'm very energized right now. I have had a long week, and it's all culminating in this right now.
Yeah, okay. I, you know what? I am battling the remnants of a cold, and I think I'm going to be...
You've been feeling this cold ever since last Saturday night when you came out for Halloween with us.
Yeah, which was a really, really dumb decision.
And you wore a hoodie.
Well, I wore a hoodie. Yeah, that doesn't sound like much in this 1 degree weather we have. 1 degree Celsius weather.
It wasn't 1 degree when we went out, though.
It was probably worse than 1 degree outside.
I don't know. Maybe. Oh, yeah. When we were walking home that night, yeah, it was pretty... let's explain, Wei, what we were going out as.
I was wearing a hoodie, which might not sound like a lot, but in comparison to what you, Jason Agnew, Justin Terry were wearing, I was...
80s aerobics instructor outfits.
It might as well have been a parka that my hoodie was, because these guys were all out in short shorts, tank tops, headbands, fanny packs. Knee-high socks, as is the usual Halloween uniform when you hang out with Jason Agnew and crew. And stupidly, I decided to join you guys this year.
Stupidly?
And I got sick, as I expected.
Well, I was very concerned because we went out, myself, Mr. Agnew, Justin, and Rob Scott. We went out again on the Wednesday night, which was the actual Halloween night. And... I was of your mindset on the Wednesday. I was very worried about getting sick because the very next morning I had to be up super early to catch a plane ride with you to Montreal. And the last thing I wanted was to be traveling, working all day, and sick. So I wore a hoodie on the Wednesday night and did not feel any guilt about it. But Halloween actual Halloween night, though, was terrible. There's nobody out. It was horrible.
It's a Wednesday night.
Well, so. I've gone out on Halloween on Wednesdays prior. I don't know if maybe the weather turned some people off, or maybe Halloween just as a thing is kind of dying down outside of girls that want to wear provocative outfits to clubs.
Perhaps.
If you don't, maybe that's the future of Halloween. It's just it's a club thing for young adults. Rather than a trick-or-treat kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe. Although I still see kids out, especially... on the drive home that
day. Did people come to your house on Halloween night?
No, I got home late, pretty late this time.
Are your parents those kind that just turn the lights off on Halloween?
Yeah.
Oh, I hated those houses.
Boy, why would we turn the lights on if we didn't have anything to give?
Oh, you should give something out. It's Halloween.
Right. Well, I can't say that last year.
I would have given you lost stickers.
Seriously. Oh, a lot of kids.
Think of it as a promotional opportunity.
True, many kids missed out. You know what? I would have probably given them like maybe
old observers,
business cards. Yeah, sure.
You could film it.
Yeah,
I'm surprised you weren't asked to go film some like trick or treating stuff.
Yeah, because I'm usually called out to some bullshit shoots on these days.
You got to document life, Way. That's what you're here for.
Well, you know, the year prior, I actually made an effort to buy some candy and to give out candy to some kids. And you know what? By the end of the evening, I had probably, like, you know, I had only given out maybe a quarter of my bag of candy. The kids just, I guess in my neighborhood at least, don't really go out too much anymore. It's I guess my neighborhood's maybe grown up.
Maybe. That's too bad. I loved Halloween when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Always looked forward to Halloween and dressing up.
What was your favorite costume as a child?
I did take pride in a costume that I got somewhat made fun of in grade 3, where I went as a Commodore computer.
Seriously?
I got a large box, and I cut arms out so I could fit my arms in and put it on my body, mm-hmm. and then put a keypad on my chest,
uh-huh.
and then took a piece of cardboard with elastic to put around my face as a monitor.
Wow.
This thing was so hard to walk with. It was a giant box, and I had to walk around. I won best costume for all kids in grade. It was 2 or 3. I think it was grade 3.
That's very creative. You came up with that yourself?
My mom helped me. She was like, you should go as a computer. I was like, how can I go as a computer? So it was just very awkward because I always remember dropping some candy that night and I couldn't pick it up in this box.
This?
So the next year I went as Kelly Gruber.
Seriously?
Yeah, the baseball player.
Oh, okay.
The following year.
I thought Kelly Gruber was like a character on 90210 or something.
No. That was Kelly Taylor.
Yeah. Right. Your mom made you dress up as a computer. That sounds to being like she was playing a practical joke on
you. No.
How can I make my kid look like the most ridiculous thing?
I won my contest.
You did win.
What about you? What was your most memorable outfit?
They're not very memorable at all. So I can't really. All my costumes really sucked. I think this one year I was a big Jays fan, so I went in as a Jays fan.
A Jays fan?
Yeah.
I hated the people who showed up at school or something and they were just wearing their normal clothes. Oh, I'm dressed up as a student. Ha! Huh, get it?
Well,
really
that,
funny.
That wasn't really that. I mean, for me, I was only a Jays fan because we never could have afforded the those actual Jays jerseys, the replica jerseys. And so I bought like a shirt, like a Blue Jays World Series shirt.
Oh, great.
And I brought my glove out, and that was my outfit.
Oh, that's at least...
Nah, fuck Halloween. It sucked.
Oh, you're just a miserable person.
It's terrible.
Nah, come on. I was always a big Halloween fan. That's great to know. I'm picturing you as a Jays fan right now.
Yeah.
All right. Let's chat about Rahway. This was from November of 1997, the go-home show for a little show known as Survivor Series 97. And what an interesting time period in wrestling history this was.
It sure was.
A lot of people, I'm sure, our age way would say this was the golden period of professional wrestling. Raw was on the rise. Nitro was super hot at this point. And we were going into a match that I think had a lot of anticipation, but no one could possibly have a prayer, a clue of the ramifications that match would have.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, tell me, leading into Survivor Series, what was your perception of the events as they occurred?
In terms of what was going on behind the scenes?
Yeah.
I had no idea. I was 13 at this point, so I had no clue about this stuff.
So you were
stuff.
You're simply out there, fresh, off of your Halloween as a Commodore computer watching.
This was 97, way.
No, okay. Well, whatever.
Actually, that Halloween, that was the spray paint year of that story I told
you.
Oh. Yeah.
What's that story?
I told this story a few weeks ago.
You were spray painted houses?
I spray painted the side of a school.
Oh,
on
wow.
Halloween.
Shit.
Yeah, I felt very guilty about
you're
it.
Badass.
Yeah, I'm not.
What did you write?
I can't remember what it was, but I was out with some people, and they had spray paint. Dumb.
And you're like, let me try that.
Yeah, I guess so.
Like your name?
No, I didn't put my name.
Your tag?
My tag. I didn't even know what a tag was at that point in time. I don't know. I can't remember. I honestly can't. All right. Again, I was 13 years old.
Where did you do this? Where did you commit this crime?
It was at this random street. It was called Withycombe. I can't remember.
That sounds made up.
It's just I'm making that up. I just thought of
my
favorite Creed album, Weathered, with Honeycombs, putting it together.
Well, I was going to say, if you ever get the chance, you should go and visit this location and see if your tag is still up there. 15 years later.
I doubt that. What were we talking about? November of 97.
Yeah, so you're...
Oh, right.
You weren't very privy to any of
the only quote-unquote insider news I would get, because I didn't have the internet at this point, certainly was not subscribing to The Observer at this point, which would have just been a mindfuck to be getting The Observer at 13.
Yeah.
I would have been king shit at school with all my fucking knowledge.
Maybe.
Because there's a key... When you're 13 years old, you never cite sources. You would just become the source.
Yeah. It's like you would be plugged into the Matrix.
Yeah. You know? Like, I already, the day after pay-per-views, people would always know I would know what happened on pay-per-views, and people would come ask me what happened at the pay-per-view.
Well, you were, for all intents, the Dave Meltzer of your school.
I guess so. I guess in a weird way I was. And I remember always bugging, because I always wanted to watch these fucking pay-per-views, and I had to deal with Scramble Vision. And by the age of 13, I was like, I'm kind of getting tired of this Scramble Vision bullshit. I can justify this at 8 and 9, but 13, this is becoming a little stupid.
Silly.
So I always was asking friends, who has pay-per-view? Who has pay-per-view? Who can get me pay-per-view? And there was one guy in my class, Jeremy Lung. And he had pay-per-view. And I was like, all right, Jeremy, let's make a deal. Every pay-per-view, I'm going to give you a VHS tape, and I want you to record it for me. And he was like, okay, I can record it for you. He had a black box, by the way.
Okay,
so it's not like I was making this guy spend $30. I was just record it. It's 8 to 11.
This is a completely honest transaction using an illegal device.
Yeah, there you go. I had no problem with this. I was paying money for a VHS. He was committing the illegal act. So anyway, I was simply an accomplice. And every time he would either forget or he would bring it back, and the VHS would feature the pay-per-view with no volume, and it was in black and white. And I could never understand this. It's like, how do you fuck this up, Jeremy? How do you mess this up? Like, I just want a pay-per-view. Why is it so goddamn hard for me to watch pay-per-view? It made me so angry. And thus, when I finally got pay-per-view like a year after this, I felt like I had struggled for so long. I think it would be a close representation would be like, for you move out and you always have to walk like 5 blocks to the laundromat every week. And then you finally move into a place that has its own washer and dryer.
Mm.
And it's just crazy.
Mm-mm-mm.
That's what getting pay-per-view was.
Yeah.
Like. So anyway, my limited insider knowledge came from a hotline hosted by a guy who called himself Sushi X.
What?
Yes.
Where was this?
This was just a random hotline that my buddy Mike found, all these wrestling hotlines. He was the only guy that was like into wrestling as much as I was. And he found these hotlines, and we would always call in. They were free as well. And I was just mystified by this. And it was basically guys cutting promos and giving out wrestling news. And then my buddy was like, well, dude, there's now another hotline, a competing hotline. And then the guys would start cutting promos on other guys' hotlines,
whoa,
like bashing each other. And me and my friend were like, we would call this every day. Like, oh. And there got to be up to like 5 hotlines. And I can't remember any of them except for Sushi X.
Sushi X.
And that was my insider knowledge at the age of 13 was Sushi X.
These were the Monday or Tuesday morning pro wrestling wars.
They did like multiple hotlines a day. Wow. I don't know how they made money off this.
Probably didn't. Probably much like this podcast.
Yeah. But this is spreading awareness. I guess that's what they were looking for.
Yeah, I suppose so. Well, that's some very good insight into the mindset of John Pollock watching this particular
episode.
How
about yourself, Wei?
I wasn't watching at this time.
Of course not. It was hot.
Yeah.
You were you were still getting off that incredible period of 95.
96.
95, yeah. 96.
I suppose, I mean, a lot of people know this, but like after Brett took off after WrestleMania 12 for that period, I guess I just kind of stopped watching wrestling for a time. And I guess I had always kind of heard about it. You know what? A big portion of me still following at this time was because I was big into sports at this time. So I listened to a lot to the sports radio station here, The Fan. And I remember a show that was on very late at night on The Fan called Game, mm-hmm. hosted by Jeff Merrick. And it was actually a precursor to The Law in many ways. Jeff Merrick and I think Donnie Abreu would occasionally call in. And so I would listen to it, and all of a sudden...
And that featured, like, George Strombolopoulos, I think, producing.
Bob Mackowitz. Yeah, those three. Yeah, they hosted that show. And I brought it up to George Strombolopoulos one time when we were working at CFRB, and he's like, yeah, The Game. And that was it. But yeah, Game was awesome because they were the first show on the radio to actually talk about professional wrestling and talk about it in a way that wasn't, all kayfabe. And so it really opened my eyes. So I'd always listened to that, but I never really followed wrestling. And because part of the reason was because I didn't know what time it was on. Exactly at what point did we start getting Raw on TSN on Mondays?
It wasn't live on Monday nights till like late 98.
Oh, really? Yeah. So even at this point, when they were addressing TSN back, you know, even with Survivor Series being in
It was airing like, I think it was still Tuesdays at 4 o'clock at this point.
Wow.
And if ever there was something like curling or something, Raw would get preempted. Mm. I mean, you certainly, I think there's more of a connection to, I think, the product. If you came up during this time where you really had to work to follow the product at times, whereas yeah. today I just, there's zero problem. You miss a show, boom, you find it online.
Yeah.
It's you don't have that same kind of
you didn't have to resort
seeking
to,
out.
You didn't have to resort to forcing your buddy to record your shows on your VHS.
Yeah, but you know what? A lifelong friend out of it. He just got married, yeah. actually, Jeremy. So congratulations.
All right. Well, great.
Yeah.
Did you make him tape it?
He didn't tape it. No,
he
probably would have been in black and white, and I couldn't hear the vows. Yeah. So. Anyway, we move on to the actual program here from Hershey Park, Pennsylvania. Interesting trivia note, Way. Most people probably assume November 3rd, 97 Raw, the final Raw appearance by Bret Hart. Not the case. Mm. Bret Hart was not on this show.
He was not. Absolutely not.
And we start off the show, and they had the first hour announced team and the second hour announced team as Jim Ross was joined by Todd Kennelly.
I really liked the they also had the thorn in your eye intro with the flaming ring and then Austin walking in.
Yes.
This was always my favorite intro for Raw.
Probably the highest production yeah. of an intro they've ever done.
Well, they shot specific scenes for it. They didn't just use highlight footage, which ultimately you understand why they don't do that anymore because of the changing roster.
So well, even at this point, I mean, Brett was in this
right.
in this warehouse scenics and they had to get rid of those.
They couldn't use much of that. Thank goodness they had the foresight to shoot all that stuff with Austin, which they ended up using for quite a time. But I always liked this video. I thought it was a major departure from what came before it, and the production value was just really good. And the mute song was awesome. To me, it's still my favorite Raw theme song.
Just such a violent image.
Yeah.
A thorn in your eye.
Right. And
not in your side.
In my eye. Oh, it really hurts.
I joke there. It was Todd Kennelly. It was actually Jim Ross and Jim Cornette.
Oh, I didn't notice.
Yes.
Sorry.
What an underrated and quite forgotten announced duo. Jim Ross and Jim Cornette here calling Raw at, some would say, the best year in Raw's history in 1997. Hmm. And they did a pre-show tease here right before teasing Austin on the show, a dog collar match, and then, as Way mentioned, the thorn in your eye intro, very hot crowd off the bat in Hershey Park, Pennsylvania, as Jim Ross promotes the purest form of freedom of expression you can ever imagine in the WWF.
What does that mean?
I guess you can, none of your signs would get confiscated. Maybe that's what they mean, because WWF would never do that.
Oh, okay.
Wear whatever t-shirts you want. We found out in the Road Dogg Billy Gunn match that you can chant anything you want at two wrestlers.
You could say anything you want.
Jesus Christ.
You're in the crowd, basically say anything you want.
Boy.
Well, it's not one of the seven. We'll get to that. We'll get to it.
Not to go off on a tangent, but at Bellator 79 Friday night, Casino Rama, boy, have you never lived till you've watched a fighting event at Casino-rama with that crowd.
Tell me about it.
Oh, just like, because it's obviously a very kind of intimate venue. It holds like 5,000. And if you want to yell something and there's a lull in the fight, everyone will hear you. And some of the things these people, everyone's a cornerman, first of all. Every person that bought a ticket actually has fought and is offering their services to corner everybody tell them what to do.
Use your knees.
Punch him! Punch him! There was like a break in the action and like the guys weren't really fighting. So we'll go, yo! I shaved my balls for this! Ha ha ha! And these guys are like, I'm fucking funny, man. I'm part of the show. And then this rather heavier gentleman named Josh Applett, he was fighting in the last fight of the night. Not the main event. This was a swing bout at the end. And, the guy's a little heavy. Uh-huh. So the crowd decided, yo, throw a combo! Like the Big Mac with fries and Coke.
that is
just like on this guy.
Oh, that one's good. Come on.
Oh, man. It was just like these poor fighters just at the fucking, they trained like weeks and weeks for this for a modest payday, and they got to deal with these idiots.
You know what? It should be part of the training is to deal with these hecklers.
I guess so, man.
It's like a comedian. They should be able to shout something back at them during the fight.
Best entrance of the night, though, was a swing bout at the end where the first fighter comes out and then the announcer's just like, and his opponent, here's Johnny. And out comes, to the late night music, Johnny Carson, a lightweight fighter. What's his name? Johnny Carson.
And the announcer played it up.
Doesn't play it up at all, other than the theme music. And he's coming out and he's just walking like any other fighter would. And they introduce him. The king of late night, Johnny Carson, in the red corner. And then he got murdered by Guillaume De Lorenzi.
Could be the reason why they hired him at all.
Anyway, Johnny Carson, a highlight of Bellator 79. But back to the show. Steve Austin comes out to start the show to a very, very big pop. And Vince McMahon is in the ring to interview him. Austin says that this Sunday, it isn't a wrestling match. It's a fight against Owen Hart.
Against Owen Hart. How long had Austin returned from his injury by this
He had
point?
Not wrestled at this point since it was August of 97. So this was a good 3 months.
Wow.
In between. And he was like at his hottest right now.
You're telling me he only took 3 months off after being nearly paralyzed?
Yeah.
Okay.
This period actually is when Austin really started to become a bit of a ratings draw because he couldn't wrestle, but they just found ways to work him into the show every single week without wrestling. So it was difficult, but that became a big draw. It was just seeing what they would do with Austin every week, and he starts stunning like Jim Ross and Vince McMahon. So he was certainly taking off, and based on this reaction, you could see him as a really a baby face to watch for sure. And this way, only 6 years after his Halloween Havoc match with Dustin Rhodes. 15-minute draw for the television title.
Oh, look how far he's come in 6 years.
A big difference. Yeah. As had Dustin Rhodes come a long way, also on this show.
I guess so.
Rick Rude on this show, too? Jeez, this is like reviewing Halloween Havoc 91. Jim Ross.
Mick Foley.
Holy Christ.
Yeah.
Vader.
Oh, right.
Let's see how many more we can find.
Okay.
Austin goes on to talk about the fact that he stunned Ahmed Johnson last week, who was having a match with Owen, and he explains he did it so that Owen keeps the title. He has nothing against Ahmed. He was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. And this was when Vince also mentioned the Hart Foundation are at home in Canada tonight.
This is also Ahmed Johnson in full
1997 wrestling gear.
Jeans.
Fanny pack. Tight shirt. Tight jeans.
Nothing says attitude like acid wash jeans and a fanny pack.
A fanny pack.
On Ahmed Johnson. Great look.
Fans are chanting Austin, and Ahmed Johnson was given the microphone, and I just sat back and said, oh, I love Ahmed Johnson promos.
You crossed my end zone!
You crossed my end zone!
Yeah.
That sounds mildly sexual.
You touched me down.
Was this a nice way of saying you crossed the line?
Maybe. Why?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I've never heard this.
Yeah,
term. Crossed my end zone.
I think that's what he means. Yeah.
He says he doesn't respect him, and he's going to kick his ass tonight. and they set up a match for later on. Steve Austin and Ahmed Johnson.
Dream match.
So Austin, potentially his return match, free on television. And
straight from being injured in the ring.
Yep. Against, he's going to wrestle on free TV.
Against Ahmed Johnson.
This was the WWF. They knew the art of bait and switch in 97. Jim Ross plugs an interview coming up later with Goldust and Marlena, where he rapes his wife of her dignity. That was his tag for this interview.
You got to get people to tune in. Come on.
What? Did he just say Goldust is going to rape Marlena later in the show?
Well,
if you were not paying attention to this show, that might have been your takeaway.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. Do you want to explain the Karate Fighters Holiday Tournament with Vince McMahon and Jumbo Jim?
Whoever, we found the show online, of course, and whoever decided to screen cap this, I'm so grateful they decided to keep these commercials in, because in this program, we also got to see the Karate Fighters Holiday Tournament, where karate fighters... These are some of the shittiest toys I have ever seen. If anybody bought this for me as a child, I would be just so disappointed. These were action figures on a dial, and then you just like hit buttons.
There's no skill to this at all.
You hit buttons, and they just flail their arms, these action figures. And at some point, one of them is gonna pop out. It's like Rock'em Sock'em Robots, except with it's just much lamer. And in 1997, so they had a tournament in these commercials.
An 8-person tournament with brackets.
With brackets between.
We don't get that for most like WWF title tournaments.
Between a number of WWE personalities to promote this, and so calling this action are Jumbo Jim and Vince McMahon,
who I think were Wayne and Adam, who were – the guy Adam is like an editor with WWE who is like the redheaded kid that Shawn Michaels once mentioned in a promo and does all of those. If you've ever watched a WWE promo video package and been like, fuck, was that great, odds are it was this guy Adam.
He was actually in this commercial briefly at the beginning, just a shot of it.
And it was these two guys that they tried to do comedy sketches with, and they were always terrible. Like, always terrible. And this was their latest incarnation.
You had Jumbo Jim and Vince McMahon, doing the Vince and Jim Ross impressions. And on this particular match, we had Carlos Cabrera taking on Tito Santana.
Who morphed into his wrestling gear, Tito Santana
Via spin.
His El Matador green outfit.
Tito Santana spins and transforms, as you said, into his gimmick. And then they cut promos on each other, and then they tap the stupid dials on these action figures. And these are just some terrible toys.
I don't know how much money Karate Fighters sponsored WWF for this point to get this tournament. And as I recall, the finals of this tournament were put on Raw.
What?
Like in the middle of the ring. Oh, like they must have kicked in a ton of money. I know WWF was hard up for money in late 97, but Jesus Christ. They spent above and beyond for Karate Fighters and getting their business. Mm-hmm. Sunny comes out. She is the guest ring announcer for our next match for the light heavyweight tournament. Another tournament. They could have killed off two birds with one stone and had the winner of the Karate Fighters tournament win the light heavyweight title.
Yeah.
Call it the Karate Fighting title.
Okay.
Make them all Karate Fighters. Bring in a young 14-year-old Lyoto Machida.
Right. Yeah.
They do show the brackets of other members of this tournament, including Devin Storm, Flash Flanagan, and Jerry Lynn.
Right.
And Jerry Lynn would actually not compete in this tournament. And Jerry Lynn he explained this on Colt Cabana's podcast, that he had been talking with them, but they never came to an agreement. And then one night he gets a call that, hey, they put you in the brackets for this tournament on Raw. Jerry Lynn's like, I didn't agree to that.
Who ended up replacing him?
I can't remember. Not sure. Anyway, this match we had Super Loco, which if you translate means super crazy.
Right.
Taking on Aguila / what did Cornette call him? Aguila? Yeah. We had two pronunciations for it.
Aguila.
Aguila.
What's the right one?
I don't know. I always heard Aguila was how they called him afterwards. I never am a stickler on pronunciations unless it's just terrible butchering, but I like uniformity. Just pick one and go on. With Ross and Cornette calling him two different names, jarring.
Yeah.
Match begins with Brian Christopher on commentary. And Aguila, this was the WWF's answer to the cruiserweight division. Mm. And at a time when they allowed these guys to work their style and have to do quote-unquote WWE style.
And after a match like this, I could see why they would put an end to that very quickly.
This
was awful.
This was a spot fest.
Well,
hey, there was some impressive shit. There was also some terrible stuff.
From Aguila, but Super Crazy should be so glad they forced him to change his name here, because this match should be wiped off of his record permanently. This was a terrible performance.
Aguila hit a tilt-a-whirl and then a moonsault off the top into an arm drag. Loco comes off to the apron into the guardrail and takes a corkscrew plancha by Aguila. Then we saw a springboard heel kick by Loco. Then he goes for another one with Aguila crotched on the top rope, completely missing him.
Did you... That springboard plancha, too. He ran at the ropes and just like... Aguila is on the outside waiting for the high spot to come out. And then Crazy jumps off the ropes. He just gets tangled as he's bouncing into the ropes. And it turns into nothing. What was that? On live TV?
I also enjoyed how Jim Cornette had to put this over, because Jim Cornette hates this stuff. He hates it. But had to sell this as just revolutionary.
Brian Christopher certainly wasn't. He just started
laughing. Brian Christopher didn't give a fuck about this.
He just started laughing at all this.
Oh, there was one point where he just openly laughed at Loco botching a spot.
Yeah.
Gory special by Loco, and then a cartwheel into a helo to the floor. He hit that.
Yeah.
Moonsault to the floor.
The one thing he did hit.
Yeah, that looked impressive. Then goes for a corkscrew off the top. Loco does, misses, takes a missile dropkick, gets sent to the floor. Aguila hits a moonsault off the top rope to the floor. And then in the ring, he comes off the top and pins Loco at 509.
A lot of big moves. Aguila looked really good. Crazy blew it big time. But you know, despite all the flashy maneuvers, crowd did not really react loudly to any of these high spots. They just didn't seem to care about any of this, good or bad.
Jim Ross then is appalled as he throws to his interview he conducted earlier with Dustin Rhodes and Marlena. And to set the scene here, this was following the angle where Marlena had lost the indecent proposal match to Brian Pillman, and therefore Marlena was taken hostage by Brian Pillman for 30 days. Of course, Pillman had passed away the month prior, so they kind of just had to cool and kill this angle off. But now it was a month later, and they had to address things. And Marlena was back home with Dustin, and they were going to give Jim Ross an exclusive update on their life. And Rhodes is there wearing his headband.
Completely out of character.
Yes, this is all out of character. No face paint.
No. Calling each other Terry and Dustin.
Yes, yes. And Marlena explains that she told her child, Mommy was on a long vacation, and Rhodes, during this entire time, is just looking disgusted and finally says he's sick of what is coming out of her mouth, and says he's sick of his dad, he's sick of Terry, and trying to live his life for other people, and said, do you think I was at home for 30 days while you were doing God knows what? I was out on the prowl, looking for a woman who understood me, and I found a woman, and I don't love you anymore. Here's your ring, and you can shove it up your ass, along with this marriage. And Marlena is just stunned at this news.
Right.
I remember at the time thinking that this was so awkward. Maybe I just compare it to today's acting and the fact that I don't think almost anyone could pull this off. I thought both were great here.
I did too. I had no idea what the storyline actually was, but I thought the performances were tremendous.
I thought Terry was so good here. Yeah. I was trying to suspend my disbelief. I was like, okay, let's imagine this is happening on live TV. And this almost felt like, I don't know if you're familiar with the infamous interview Mike Tyson and Robin Givens did. It was on a live TV special, and Robin basically just buries Mike in front of him and talks about how he He's like addicted to, he drinks vodka like it's water. He pops pills. He's a horrible husband. It was very, I think they maybe took from that here. But anyway, I thought Terry was like, if you could actually envision this is happening on WWF television, this is probably how a woman would react to her husband dumping her on live television.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Anyway, I so badly wanted a cutaway to Jim Ross as all this is going on, and he's just sitting there uncomfortable.
Oh, Ross would have been great, too. But
these interviews were great in 97 with Mick Foley. Yeah. They teased one with Jeff Jarrett that they didn't air on this show, and with Dustin Rhodes. Mm-hmm. Like, Ross was really able to take characters to another level with these interviews. I think they're very underutilized today in terms of when we talk about not having a lot of depth to a number of these characters. That's what a lot of these interviews certainly achieved with Dustin Rhodes, yeah. Especially with Mick Foley. He's the go-to.
I think a big part that exemplifies that aspect of Jim Ross is coming back from commercial, Jim Ross, you know, the camera is on Jim Ross and he has to react to this, and he just does a great job selling the severity of the interview. Just he just has that look where he looked into the camera and convince you that what you just saw was serious and that was terrible. He basically comes back on camera, chastises Dustin Runnels for not being a man.
Into the mirror. He's gutless.
He just can make Jim Ross can just make an angle that much more believable.
I mean, how Dustin Rhodes went from a babyface to a heel in these 10 minutes,
and
Ross just burying him like this made him such a you just hated this man.
Yeah, and who was the woman that he ended
it would be
up?
Luna.
Oh, okay.
And it was then he became the artist formerly known as Goldust, which was a horrendous gimmick. Mm. Then we got maybe my favorite part of the show. It was their video for Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels to build up their match for this Sunday. And it featured interviews with Hart and Shawn going back and forth. It starts off with Bret saying, "Well, I hope I don't have to run him over with my car." And it goes back to WrestleMania 12 and their match. And Hart cites the fact that Michaels has a lack of masculinity. "I'm sick of the dancing, the twirling, and that Mexican style of wrestling that makes you sick." Coming off the last match, this could not have been more well-timed. "That Mexican style, that Mexican wrestling stuff that makes you sick." Michaels then, in his interview, is talking about how he calls the title a stupid piece of tin.
He does, yeah.
Don't know what the point of that was. And then Bret says, "Michaels might have his fans, but I feel that the truckers, the coal miners, and the lumberjacks who come home after a long day of work, they're fans of Bret Hart." This was so great.
Those are some pretty funny lines. I just love the way they dressed up the whole thing. They all dated it back to the last time these two wrestled at WrestleMania 12. And, you know, starting off with the shoot comments from the night of the Slammies before that match.
Yeah.
Where Bret wins a Slammy, and up on stage he makes a remark about how, "Tomorrow night, Shawn, you're gonna, what you felt in Syracuse,
those 9 cheerleaders beating you up,
would be nothing compared to what I do to you tomorrow." And the whole crowd going, ooh. And it really just shows the shift in the way they tell the stories between that point and right now in 97, where that comment was not referenced to at all on that broadcast of WrestleMania 12. But here, it seemed like they were going the ultra realistic route, and knowing as much as we do know now about the feud between these two, having seen Wrestling with Shadows and whatnot, you can really tell that this feud, much of what it was composed of was evidence of Vince encouraging them to use their real life animosity to propel his own business, to propel the storyline.
If you go back and you were to watch, like, from, like, SummerSlam through Survivor Series and watch the Raws leading up to that, it was like whenever Bret and Michaels did promos, there was that you knew these guys legit did not – they had problems with one another, and it made their promos come across so believable. And by this point, I don't know how you were not ordering the Survivor Series. Mm-hmm. Like, controversy aside, no one knew that going in. Just as a match – I just thought they built this up so well.
This was a fantastic video to encompass that entire feud into 5 minutes.
And an interesting trivia note is that this is the 97 was the 1 year where Survivor Series did more buys than WrestleMania.
Is that right? Wow.
Ahmed Johnson comes out ignoring the format sheet. He wants his match with Austin now. And the lights go out. And Kane comes out. This is my segment.
Kane, who had debuted just a month earlier at Bad Blood.
He comes out with Paul Bearer. Johnson attacks him, and the lights are dimmed here in red, much like Sin Cara had.
Right.
And Kane chokeslams Ahmed.
Except Kane never had matches in this light.
Yes, he did.
Oh, he did?
Yes, he would. It would be very brief.
Oh, God.
Kane chokeslams Ahmed. Sets off his pyro, and then delivers two tombstones, both of which look very snug.
Yeah, and it's been a long time since I've seen Kane do tombstones, but at least at this point in his career, it seemed like he was struggling much of the time.
Ahmed's head came dangerously close to the mat on both of these.
Yeah.
So Ahmed is laid out. Mankind runs in, applies the mandible claw to Paul Bearer, and then he has this metal-like turnbuckle post that he hits Kane with, and then it bends upon impact. So this had to have been gimmicked in some form.
Of course it had.
But I don't know how they pulled this off. It looked great.
You just cast it in aluminum.
In aluminum?
Yeah.
No, they showed it up close. You could see if this was wrapped in aluminum.
No, not aluminum foil. I mean, you make one out of aluminum or another soft metal. There's no way that this was steel.
I'm not saying it was. I think this looked great.
Yeah,
I was puzzled of how they did this. Do you remember when they tried this in WCW once with a 2x4? They gimmicked the 2x4, and they hit them, and the 2x4 bent in half. Anyway, so Kane then sits up. Mankind has a chair on the floor. And what was strange here is that at Survivor Series, it was Kane against Dude Love.
Okay.
Why?
I don't know.
We had a gang promo for Survivor Series with The Nation and Los Barricos because the tagline, do you remember what it was for Survivor Series that year?
Gang rules.
With a Z.
R-U-L-Z. Rolls. Gang rolls.
Gang rolls.
There's some bad commercials, man, back in the late 90s. There was also one for the Stone Cold shirt, which reads...
which comes in a can.
100% can of whoop-ass on the front. And yes, it comes in its own... metal can.
And can you guess what the can is labeled with?
Austin.
100% pure whoop-ass.
Can of whoop-ass. Yeah.
You know how you get that shirt? You have to open up a can of whoop-ass.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not wearing my shirt anymore. I guess I got better put it into this can.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Austin comes out. Dude, it was 97.
Listen, man. Oh, come on. You look at the company today and the stuff they put their logo on. This company has just never been known to deliver high-quality merchandise to its audience, okay? I'm the same guy who's saying this who owns, like, a fucking WWE thermometer. Like,
what?
Made in China. I don't know.
A thermometer?
I probably got something from like the law or something when I was working with you guys where like you guys had like some prize packs.
Do they have the heels at the top of the thermometer? The one has the most heat?
That actually would be clever.
Yeah.
Then you would have like maybe, what is it? Aces and Eights at the bottom, even though it's a completely
no
different
heat.
Company.
Yeah. Dead.
Cold.
Austin comes out. Says that Ahmed got off light, and he issues an open challenge to anyone in the back. And Cornette says, there aren't a lot of frogs in the back because no one is jumping. And then the Nation of Domination theme hits, and they come out. Farouk, Rocky Maivia, D'Lo Brown, and they are walking behind Kama Mustafa. Mm. Kama is going to take him up on the challenge.
Oh, who's allegedly, as Jim Ross tells us, 6'8". 6'8", 300 pounds.
Well, unfortunately, the dream match with Kama and Austin would not occur. As Legion of Doom run down to attack the Nation, Austin stuns Kama and Animal here in his Zubaz pants.
Oh, yes.
97, still clinging to those Zubaz.
This is reality.
These wrestlers, this is where what they were in real life.
Well, the Road Warriors, they had a stake in the actual Zubaz company.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, they thought it was going to be a moneymaker. Anyway, heads to the back. That ends the first hour. Then we got a promo for another one of their blue chip sponsors, Laser Tag, Laser Forces or some shit, with the tagline, "The future is now and the future is Laser Tag." Spoiler, future was not Laser Tag.
No, it was not.
You ever a laser tag fan?
Never. I've never been.
I did. I did go to laser tag a few times.
Laser Quest and
Laser Quest, yeah.
You know, it could
Laser Quest was the best.
I think it could be the future once we actually use lasers for the police. Like when lasers become powerful enough, I think all the future of gang violence is lasers. So it could be the future still.
What about taser tag?
There's an idea. There's a birthday party.
You know what I liked about this show, Way? We had a first hour announce team and a second hour announce team, and the transition was seamless to Vince McMahon, Jim Ross, and Jerry Lawler. Cornette was not standing there as Lawler and Vince shook his hand and shooed him off.
Yeah. I'm convinced that they're working some type of angle with the TNA broadcast teams. Otherwise,
I don't want that.
What the hell is the point of doing that?
I don't want to see Jeremy Borash and Todd Kennelly in an angle.
Something's going to happen one day. Somebody's going to attack somebody else. Like Tom Kennelly is going to use a turnbuckle post to attack Mike Tenay. And then at that point, we're all going to go, holy shit.
Taz and Kennelly at Bound for Glory next year.
Yeah.
A Kennelly from Hell cell match.
Yes. You know what? I realized here that the first hour of this show was complete. I did not feel it at all. It went by very quickly.
Dude, this show was paced great. I was never bored during this show.
I was very entertained by it. The crowd was very hot throughout, except for that Aguila super local.
And that was the lone match in 1 hour, and I did not have any problem with it. You know what was a lot more important? Teasing Austin, which was, you know, you're trying to drive ratings here of teasing an Austin match. Yep. I had no problem with that. The Bret Hart, the Hart Michaels video, the Rhodes angle, like there was important stuff here that was way more important than matches.
Yeah.
So I had no problem here. Some people complain, oh, we only got 4 minutes of wrestling. Buy a pay-per-view.
Yeah.
That's where you get your wrestling. Mm-hmm. Go to a house show. Half of Michael Cole was in the ring to bring out Shawn Michaels, Rick Rude, and Triple H.
Half of Michael Cole, yes.
This man has got to have put on 50 pounds in the last 15 years.
Yeah, very likely.
He was like smaller than you and me.
Pretty much. You know what? And after a segment like this, you could see why he decided to hit the gym and, you know, bulk up.
I don't know if he's really bulked up in the gym way as opposed to just eating on the road.
Well,
more.
For a time he was. He's certainly gotten a bit rounder now, but like for a time he was like, you know, pretty good, in pretty good shape.
Yeah, he was ungodly. You know what? For this role as the interviewer,
you
want a pipsqueak. Yep. You want a guy that looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, Cole...
So you and I would be perfect.
Maybe. Brings out DX. They do their usual promo here. Michaels comes out here. He's got a cup of coffee with him. And the announcers tease that this Sunday could be the last time Michaels and Brett are ever in the same ring at the same time.
So did they acknowledge, like, how much did they acknowledge that Brett had signed with WCW?
Brett had technically signed with WCW by the time this show had aired, but it was not really out yet. I think it got out the day after this Raw.
Oh, wow.
So most of, the newsletters and hotlines and stuff, I think, got wind of it. And as of this day...
November 3rd, 1996.
Yeah. That, like, Dave Meltzer has the foremost rundown of everything that happened, like, down to the detail. If you go back, it's like the November 10th or November 17th edition of The Observer from that year. He has a timeline, like day by day, of what happened. And as of this day, because I was just scanning through my issue of this before we did the show, on this day, the plan was Brett would beat Michaels at Survivor Series and then drop the title the next month at the In Your House event. But then it got into all this craziness that Bischoff would go on Nitro the next night, say, we've signed the champion, the news was out. Anyway, I'm sure we'll chat about this a lot more next week. But that's where things stood at this point. And So they come out. They show a video of Brett against Ken Shamrock from the week prior, with Brett having Shamrock in the sharpshooter and Michaels running in to superkick Brett, and then Shamrock attacked Shawn Michaels. The interview begins, and before Michaels speaks, he kisses Triple H on the lips and then kisses China on the lips.
Yeah.
This was like a odd game of would you rather, and he chose both.
It was completely unprovoked. He just decided to do it. And you know what? It's actually become a shot that they've used quite often in the past.
There's also a picture out there of, I think this was on a house show, of Vince McMahon kissing Shawn Michaels on the lips, Shawn just grabs him and like kisses him.
Okay.
I guess Shawn was playing with this idea at the time that how can I become a heel more to this audience? And you know what? Based on the crowd reaction for a later match, I guess this was an easy way to get heat.
I guess so.
Make out with Triple H.
I was very much confused by the heel face dynamic here because you had Bret Hart, who was doing his anti-American gimmick, and you also had Shawn here, who was also a heel. So
it was, but for whatever reason, it worked because above all the heel stuff, it was two people you knew hated each other, and that almost superseded this.
Right.
So. Anyway, I was trying to find it to show you, but yeah, it's an image we cannot find. Anyway,
maybe you turn off safe search. Maybe that you'll be able to find it then. I'm just kidding. You don't have to do that.
It's on moderate.
All right.
So anyway, the promo continues, and Michaels goes on talking about he's the main event, and then goes to call himself the wrestling god. Pre-JBL, and Hunter cuts him off saying, no, to call yourself God in wrestling means you have to be as old as God. And he makes a crack about age in the cage, which was the week prior at Halloween Havoc.
Right. At this point, Michael starts strumming his European title like a certain mustached, blonde, balding champion on another show.
Hunter gained points for me talking about Pontius Pilate making the turn.
What?
Pontius Pilate is like the was this character in the Bible who was like a babyface, for lack of a better term, that ends up turning heel on Jesus. And Pontius Pilate was aligned with King Herod. And Pontius Pilate presented himself as this good guy. But then I think it was like during one of the Stations of the Cross, Pilate turned on Jesus. And Triple H referenced here Pilate turning. The big Pontius Pilate turn, or something he calls it here. Oh. Anyway, as
interesting.
Someone that was in Catholic school at this point, I got the reference.
Hmm.
Anyway, Michael says that next week he's going to walk out on Raw naked. And he's going to show the world's most dangerous man his most dangerous man, insinuating, I am going to put my penis into Ken Shamrock's mouth.
Or somewhere else.
Somewhere else. He is going to violate Ken Shamrock.
Yeah. No, he's a bad guy.
Vince's response was, I guess that means he will challenge Ken Shamrock.
Yeah.
This was I think nothing was off limits at this point. It's like, how are we going to get people to tune in as opposed to Nitro? Let's promise male nudity.
Yeah.
Odd.
Not odd, though.
Odd, I think.
No, it's not odd.
Would this be a turn on or a turn off?
There's no way. You're going to make me sound like a It's a turn on, okay? simply because there's a shock factor here. And I'm like, wow. Like, this is me going from watching Duke the Dumpster Drossy on wrestling to all of a sudden, a year later, oh shit.
That's Shawn Michaels' dick.
Show nudity.
Sergeant Slaughter comes out, and DX puts on face masks to prevent the spit from hitting them. And then they put wipers on the masks.
These actually wipe.
hell of a invention here. Anyway, you could say that these guys really pushed how much comedy you could get away with and still keep a guy like as a super hot heel, which is what Shawn Michaels accomplished at this time.
Right. Yeah. I never got the sense that they were too likable. Although they really were by the end of this.
The end of it, yeah. They did become baby faces. Anyway, it leads to Slaughter making a match with Shawn Michaels and Ken Shamrock for later tonight. Then we go to the back, and Mark Merrow is looking for Sable and goes to the dressing room that reads Sable with a star underneath it. And Sable's getting dressed, and we got some side boob, boy.
Yeah.
On USA Network. She's not ready. I'm not ready, Mark.
Nope.
And he just hauls her out of there. Tits hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to 1997 WWF.
Yeah.
Then we got Savio Vega against Mark Merrow. This is what Mark was in such a rush for. And Lawler here says, if Merrow's so interested in boxing, he should go fight Mike Tyson. And Vince gets excited and says, I would love to see that.
Yeah, some foreshadowing.
Yes. Merrow ducks a punch and drops Savio with a right hand, punches him in the corner. Vega hits a spinning heel kick in the corner, but then misses another spin kick. And Merrow hits a low blow behind the referee's back and hits the TKO for the win at 2 minutes and 32 seconds.
Another heel-heel match.
Yeah, you're right. Michael Cole then interviews Sable about how great it is Merrow's winning all these matches. But what about the low blows? And Merrow stops the interview and says, if you want to talk to someone, you talk to me. And this interview is over. That was it. And then we go to our next match. It's Vader against the British Bulldog in a dog collar match. They announced the Patriot has a torn triceps. He's out of action, will not be at the Survivor Series this Sunday, and Vader's team, Team USA, has to find a new member. And Bulldog comes out with Team Canada, Jim Neidhart, Phil LaFon, and Doug Furness.
Jim Ross does not know why the American Doug Furness is here with these anti-American men.
Wouldn't that also be a question for Jim Neidhart?
He's married to the family.
Okay. Phil LaFon is, Phil LaFon not born in France?
Oh, yeah. Phil LaFon's Canadian. But Doug Furness.
I don't know about that, actually. One second here. Let's look this up, because I don't think Phil LaFon's Canadian either.
No, he said he was Canadian on the show.
Well, they can say one thing. Oh, no, he was born in Canada. So, my bad. We did have one Canadian on Team Canada, so that's good. All right, from there, we go to the match with Bulldog and Vader. Vader gets clotheslined to the floor. They were connected here with a chain from neck to neck. Team Canada attacks Vader, but of course, there is no DQ here. Neidhart runs into him. Lawler asks, where is Team USA? And Vince actually runs down where all the members are. Merrow's in the shower. Patriot's injured, and who knows what's up with Dustin Rhodes.
Hmm.
So, explanation there. Vader powerbombs Bulldog. Cole then, they break away from this match to interview LaFon and Furness on the floor, and Furness is upset because the two of them got into a car accident, and they got well wishes from everyone in the entire world except for any Americans.
This is why they hate USA now.
Yes. Then there was a bit of a confusion here as Vader knocks Neidhart off the apron to hit the fourth and final turnbuckle, but the announcers thought it was the third turnbuckle, so they didn't understand here when the match ended. It went just about 3.5 minutes, and then there was a post-match attack on Vader when a fan ran in, took out all the members of Team Canada, and then they ganged up on this fan, and Vader jumped on top to protect the fan, who would become Steve Blackman.
Yeah, some karate fighters.
Yeah. The living karate fighter.
Yeah. An interesting idea to introduce somebody, but, you know, I don't think it got that big of a reaction here.
Then they plug their upcoming shows, Way, including this Friday at the Sky Dome in Toronto, and then Saturday in Detroit, and then they ran through 8 straight nights of shows.
That's insane.
Holy Christ. This was the Darren Young schedule, if you were a WWF wrestler.
Right.
Then we got Jesus and Jose, Los Boricuas, against Road Dogg, Jesse James, and Billy Gunn. And the match was set up when Road Dogg accidentally tripped one of them, causing a loss to the Legion of Doom last week. Ross says that LOD is not here tonight. They were asked to leave the arena after a verbal altercation with Sergeant Slaughter, i.e., that's why they're not going to run in during this match. Small attentions to detail. The heels got the heat, and this led to a very vocal chant of faggot. Yep. I cannot believe we got this chant. I understand this was 1997 and all. Very embarrassing that a wrestling crowd. And this was a very loud and audible chant at Billy Gunn.
Yeah, times have changed.
Greatly. I guess so. Vince says that due to time constraints, their interview that they had teased all show long with Jeff Jarrett will not be airing. Instead, it will be on Livewire, where they will do a question and they will do a word association where Jarrett will talk about Hulk Hogan, Randy Savage, and as Ross labels him, my understudy, Eric Bischoff. And we, at this point, during a ratings war, I thought that interview a lot more compelling than this throwaway tag match.
Mm.
I would have made the call, let's air this interview on Raw.
Yeah.
I mean,
I would too.
People loved this, like, work shoot stuff at this time where it was still novel in wrestling. So anyway, you can tune in Saturday morning to Livewire and catch this interview. And then Ross and Ross jokes that, well if we had our own network, Vince, we could go as late as we want. Yeah, it'd be great to own your own network. Very funny. Anyway, Jesus hits a DDT in midair. Billy Gunn and Jose get tagged in. They double team James, drop him on the top turnbuckle. Billy Gunn then comes off the top with a fist to the back of the head, puts Road Dogg on top for the win. These guys went over 5 minutes, and no name for Road Dogg and Billy Gunn at this time. This was pre-New Age Outlaws, nor any theme music. They were just like two job guys that they put together and were going to give a push to.
Yeah, they certainly did have the personality of what they would come to be.
Especially Road Dogg. He really, I thought, broke out here, and they let him talk more. And
even at this point, they seem to be doing almost the exact same gimmick in terms of attitude, I guess, for lack of a better word, as D-Generation X. But they simply didn't have the branding or the relevance behind them, so people didn't really care about this. People didn't really care about this match. It wasn't really a good match at all. Didn't help that these were, again, two heel tag teams. It just seemed like everybody on the show was a heel.
Well, it was Shades of Grey at this time, Way.
Yeah.
Shades of Grey. No good guys and bad guys. So then, Way, they show a video of the previous week's Raw with Brett putting Shamrock into the sharpshooter, and then it's reversed into the ankle lock. Brett takes out the referee, and Brett is tapping. But it's only a visual, as he does not get a title change on Raw. And that leads to Michaels, of course, running in and attacking Brett. And that sets up our main event with Shawn Michaels and Ken Shamrock, the go-home show for the Survivor Series. And Shamrock attacks Shawn right at the bell. Military presses him to the floor onto Triple H and China. And Michaels does his big flip bump into the corner. Shamrock clotheslines both to the floor, and Hunter then distracts Shamrock. And this leads to Michaels trying to attack him, but Michaels gets sent into the post. And it's China who gets the upper hand, shoving Ken into the post. And then Rick Rude comes out. Michaels has the heat after the commercial break, misses as he runs shoulder first into the turnbuckle, and then Shamrock hits two reverse spinning elbows and goes for a Hurricane Rana, but Michaels responds with a sit-out powerbomb reversal, goes for the sweet chin music, Shamrock ducks, hits a belly-to-belly suplex, Hunter gets out in the apron and gets knocked down, Shamrock blocks the sweet chin music, gets the ankle lock as China distracts the referee, and Rick Rude hits Shamrock with the briefcase for the disqualification. They went about 8 minutes here, and then DX attacks Shamrock at the end, including a pedigree by Triple H onto Shamrock, onto Rick Rude's briefcase.
Obviously, the ending of this go-home show, not the perfect scenario without Brett on the show. And why wasn't Brett on this show?
I don't know. I don't know why he wasn't on this show.
Well, I really got the sense that they were priming Ken Shamrock for some type of title run here, protecting him. Well, first of all, making him competitive against Brett and Shawn, and essentially almost putting him over both of them, or at least very much protecting him against both of them. So
I think they had the idea that Ken would. They were going back and forth with whether to do, if Brett was the champion, of doing like a multi-person match at that December pay-per-view or whatever they would do. But the idea was Shamrock would be in that main event picture for the December pay-per-view. So certainly imagine that they were planning ahead.
No, I can't.
Well, a very entertaining episode of Raw. The product seemed incredibly hot, and it just...
I certainly wanted to watch that pay-per-view by the end of the show. That video I thought was fantastic, and it really was a one-match show they were selling you on, but that one match, I mean, I don't know how you wouldn't... And you multiply this by all the weeks of leading up to this and playing off the WrestleMania match and teasing this is the last time you might see these two, and then all the buzz they would get in the news in the days leading up. I mean, this felt like a pay-per-view you could not miss if you were an ardent wrestling fan at this point.
Absolutely. And then really, it was that one video package that really sold the whole thing on this one particular episode. In terms of matches, there's really not one good match on this episode of Raw, but I get the feeling that this type of crowd didn't care so much about great matches anyway. They just wanted to see the characters. They wanted to see the storylines. They wanted to hear Steve Austin come out with that music. Like the one great stand-up performer I thought here was S.A. Rios, and no reaction whatsoever for any of his spots in that match. So, it's a very different crowd, I suppose.
The Lumberjacks and the Coal Miners weren't really into that match.
No.
Bret Hart's audience. All right, well, we're going to head over to your feedback now on the Law message board, and let's start off with Chris in Ottawa. Another trip in the time machine to the late 90s and the Monday Night Wars, and I'm happy to be here. Watching Steve Austin perform makes it perfectly clear why millions of young teenage males would walk like the Texas rattlesnake to their math class every morning. I did, anyway. Austin has such presence in front of the camera, and his wild nature amplified by the crowd being so close to the action and Vince McMahon's reactions to Austin saying such terrible things like pissed off and ass. The WWF never seemed closer to complete anarchy and never has since. I've taped this episode when it aired and remember watching the Super Loco Aguila match over and over again because it made me laugh so much. I've seen Spot Fest before, but never one with so many botched spots on the Hallmark Wrestling broadcast. It sure was weird to watch Dustin Rhodes rape his wife's dignity, as JR described it, and abuse her so verbally, and see it immediately followed up by ads for Karate Fighters and Tiger Electronics laser tag. Later on, we'd nearly see Sable's Gonzagas, which was soon followed by a commercial for action figures. I guess the advertising deals hadn't caught up to the edgy product just yet. And speaking of Karate Fighters, who was Vin McMahonican? His Vince impression was much better than Bruce Pritchard's Jumbo Jim Ross. Oh, is that who it was? Is that Bruce Pritchard as Jumbo Jim? Maybe it was. That makes a lot more sense. Who just sounded like Brother Love. Insane to hear the fans chant the other F word in the not-so-distant past, not more than once, with Vince McMahon calling it fun. A reminder of how far we've come with regards to GLBT rights. I definitely remember Hollywood Hogan screaming, "I am God," into the camera at the end of the last October Nitro of 97, and had almost forgot that DX incorporated this into their promo, as well as Piper and Hogan in a steel cage match at Halloween Havoc 97. Unfortunately, judging by the reaction, there wasn't a lot of Nitro viewers in attendance at Raw. I really found this Raw to be very dull and uninteresting. That is, until I realized that it was the historic night featuring the debut of Steve Blackman. Very few people get the opportunity to debut underneath Vader like that. I found it interesting that we pine for the Attitude Era and have big issues with the amount of wrestling on Monday nights today, but this show had less than 23 total minutes of match time and no match that could even be considered average. But at least we all got to hear Shawn Michaels call a clothesline from Shamrock about as loudly as Vince did a second or two later, so it was all worth it.
Andrew Sheehy, finally, after 3 years on the air, you finally review an episode of WWF Raw as War from 97. I remember watching this show as a seven-year-old on a Tuesday afternoon during the Ontario teacher strike. The opening promo by Stone Cold Steve Austin was great. His mic work in 96 to 97 is amongst the best in the history of pro wrestling. During this time, his character was going to another level as he came out and stunned everybody each and every week while recovering from a neck injury. Aguila Super Loco was a solid light heavy heavyweight tournament match. It's too bad that the light heavyweight division was misused in the company for most of the Attitude Era. The Goldust Marlena interview was awkward to watch. It led to the artist formerly known as Goldust character in 98, which sucked big time. Kane's attack on Ahmed was well done, with Mankind hitting the Big Red Monster with a piece of metal in the end to sell their match at the pay-per-view. Blah, 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 blah. Blah, blah, blah. You're just recapping here. Okay. One thing that boggled me about this show was that there wasn't a face-to-face promo between HBK and Bret Hart with their Survivor Series match in 6 days. This episode of Raw is historic as it's the final episode of Vince McMahon as a full-fledged commentator. An okay show, 6.5 DX windshields out of 10.
That is true. This was Vince's last night calling the action on Raw. Go to Steve Sanders from LA. This was the first episode of Raw that I ever missed because I was in attendance at Nitro that night in Philadelphia. That was the night Perry Saturn made his surprise debut and beat Disco Inferno for the television title. Later that week, on my 14th birthday, I'd get to see the Montreal Screwjob on pay-per-view, so this was a crazy week of wrestling for an impressionable youngster. I recall around this time that Raw had an amazing summer of shows, but the WWF had been back to being fairly boring TV from September to December. In January of 98, things would start to pick up, so sitting back and watching the show, it's filled with guys who hadn't quite hit their stride or people I just didn't want to see. WCW still owned the WWF in terms of talent. Aside from Austin and DX, this show sucked. I give this show 3 screw jobs out of 10.
From Davey Boy, who was on this show, Stone Cold has to be the best attraction of all time. Seeing Sunny brings me back to my teenage years, looking for every magazine I could find with her in it. Sad part is this tourney was probably the only time Taka meant anything in North America, so most will not remember how good he actually was. Dustin Rhodes has always been a great worker. Shawn and Bret video package was all great for one of the best feuds to this day. I always thought Ahmed was the ultimate warrior of the 90s. The best run for Kane... Periods! Davey Boy.
Yes.
I guess his period key is broken on his machine. Watching the Outlaws here, I never would have guessed they are arguable the most talked about tag team in that era. Then there's the main event, one great worker and one underrated worker for his time, because at the time, MMA was nowhere near it. Has big talent, decent match leading into the pay-per-view, always fun going back in time. 8 out of 10.
Wow. Next up, if you're judging this as a Survivor Series go-home show, it's pretty poor. Bret doesn't even appear outside of the pretty good video package, while Shawn barely even says anything about the match in his live promo. Austin did a good job selling his need for revenge on Owen, but try as they might to get Mankind over as a threat to Kane, it doesn't work, because you know Kane is being saved for Undertaker. Looking at it as a standalone show, there's some good stuff. Austin's promo ability really went over the top in this period because they wanted him on every week, but he couldn't wrestle, and he had a couple of really good ones tonight. Vince McMahon got in one last one of maneuver here on what turned out to be his last night as a play-by-play man. The DX promo was amusing, but like I said, it didn't really do anything to sell Survivor Series. I find it kind of funny that current WWE history tells us that Shawn and Hunter were equals in the original version of DX, but going back and watching here, that's clearly not the case. Shawn is the star and Hunter's the sidekick, whose role it is to bully Michael Cole and show us where his penis is located over and over again. Oh, and we got the return of El Matador in the Karate Fighters tournament. I didn't like the Goldust Marlena thing. It was pretty uncomfortable to watch, and knowing the stupidity that followed makes it even worse. He had really been coming into his own as a babyface earlier in the year, and they flushed it away unnecessarily. Super Loco botched about half the moves he tried. The dog collar match actually had a decisive finish, which was marred by the announcers not being aware that it was the finish. Overall, taking both ways of looking at it into account, it was pretty average and not really on the level of what the WWF had been putting out over the spring and summer that year, a 5 out of 10.
And finally, from Bavin, who is in New Jersey. Thanks to Hurricane Sandy, my power was out for 6 days. I caught up with all the audio since I heard you guys were doing this show, I decided to check it out since I have all the Raw as Wars from this year. First off, I still miss the intro music they had where it was about fighting instead of being a slumber party. Also, Stone Cold shows he didn't get to the top overnight from reaction from the crowd, where by 1998, the crowd pops he would get would make the ones John Cena get sound like crickets. Ahmed Johnson should have had subtitles / a translator. I couldn't understand one word from him having marbles in his mouth. Goldust and Marlena did amazing acting, some of the best I've ever seen. They deserve a Slammy. A great build-up promo for HBK versus Bret. Now that is how you build up a match with animosity and real-life tension. Tension, unlike John Cena versus The Rock. Nice appearance by Kane. Kane Kara. Totally destroying Ahmed Johnson. Nation of Domination, an underrated group, plus soon as The Rock shows up, Rocky sucks. Okay. This year of 97 shows that what the WWF did with a roster that didn't have that many top stars to continue building younger and fresher stars. WWE could do the same today, but they choose not to, which is sad, because they have a lot of guys that could become something special. Overall, a pretty average show from 97. Before it really took off the next year.
Well, that wraps up our review of Raw from November the 3rd of 1997, going in to the Survivor Series. And wait, that is what we are going to chat about next week when we are in Montreal.
Survivor Series 1997.
An event we have put off reviewing for as long as possible.
Yeah, we're waiting for the perfect opportunity, and what better opportunity than to be in the presence of the exact place where the screw job took place.
Yeah, maybe we'll go to the streets and we'll ask people about the Montreal screw job and the effects it has had on the local economy and memories.
Yes.
Maybe we'll get someone to start crying about just the hellacious events of one Vince McMahon that evening.
I'm sure a lot of people...
The Montreal crowd.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people remember.
I wonder how many people went to that show, leaving that night, not knowing what they had watched.
Yeah.
And then later finding out that they probably watched the most famous match of the past 30 years in pro wrestling.
Oh, for instance, Ariel Helwani.
Was he there for that event?
I believe he was.
Wow. Okay, well...
He has a ticket stub.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
He brought this up with Brett in an interview.
Wow. Well... That is going to be coming up next week, our review of the 97 Survivor Series. Wei, I will plug what's coming up, and you think of a song to go out with in that time. So you can always go over to liveaudiowrestling.com. You can follow us on Twitter, at Wei0937, at Law Radio. And, of course, we do multiple shows every week, including The Law Sunday nights at midnight Eastern, review a Raw Monday nights, review an Impact on Friday mornings, and... this is up on a Wednesday, so once you're done listening to this show, you can head on over to WrestlingObserver.com, where today, later tonight, I'm going to be a guest on Figure Four Daily with Brian Alvarez and Josh Nason.
Is that right?
So go check that out. I will be on chatting numerous topics with those two as well, and you can check that show out as Wei chooses a tune to end off this edition of Review Away with. And what is your phone telling you?
Hey, you know what? 97 was a big year in the year of music, and the biggest song of which, Candle in the Wind by Elton John. So let's end off this professional wrestling podcast with a song dedicated to the death of memory and the memory of one Princess Diana.
Yes, where the song was taken as it was written for Norma Jean, and they just changed the lyrics for.
Sure. Yeah.
Is that... All right. A Candle in the Wind. Unbelievable.
I bought this single.
What?
Well, my dad bought this single.
Wow.
Hey, it was number one for a reason.
Yeah, it was a big story at the time, and people were...
Do you remember watching, or do you remember when she died?
I remember exactly, because I bought Nintendo 64 that morning and was playing Mario, and my mom came down telling us that Princess Diana had just died.
Oh, wow.
September of 97.
And what was your reaction?
I can't remember. I'm sure I kept playing my video game, though, as I took in the news.
I was getting ready to watch SNL, and I just remember being SNL being preempted because Princess Diana had just died, and all the news coverage was around this terrible accident.
And what did you think to yourself?
It's like,
this is inconvenient.
Is SNL still going to be on? No, I thought it was terrible, and I don't know. I guess the severity of the situation didn't really hit me at that age.
Fucking paparazzi. They're to blame.
Yeah, I know. And this is how people will...
Well, thanks for ending us on a downer like this way as we go out with Candle in the Wind.
Goodbye. May you help grow. You are the greatest that placed yourselves where lives were torn apart. You called out to our country and you whispered to those in pain. Now you belong to heaven and the stars spell out your name. And it seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never fading with the sunset when the rain set in. And your footsteps will always fall here along England's greenest hills. Your candles burned out long before your legend ever will. nation's golden child. Even though we try, the truth brings us to tears. All our words cannot express the joy you brought us through the years. And it seems to me you've lived your life like a candle at the wind, never fading with the sunset when the rain set in. Your footsteps will always fall here along England's greenest hills. Your candles burned out long before your legend ever will. More than you will ever know. And it seems to me you've lived your life like a candle in the wind, never fading with the sunset when the rain set in. And your footsteps will always fall here along England's greenest hills. Candles burned out long before your legend ever will.